Ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for hour number two of our big two-hour weekend get-together here on A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. Michael Harrison with you in the anchor chair, and of course, the host of the program is Carol Marks, one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism. Here now is Carol in conversation with Eva Piper. She's going to talk to Carol about her new memoir titled A Walk Through the Dark, How My Husband's 90 Minutes in Heaven Deepened My Faith for a Lifetime, published by Thomas Nelson.
Now, every story has a beginning. You were an elementary school teacher, the mother of three, and very much in love with your strong and protective husband, Don, who was a minister for youth at a Baptist church in Texas. And then, on January 18, 1989, you heard some life-changing news. What was it?
Well, I was teaching first grade, and I looked up, and our instructional aide was at our door, and motioned for me to come. I signaled to her, "Can't you see I'm worth some students?" But she insisted I come to the door, told me I needed to come to the office right away. And as I'm walking down the hall, I'm trying to figure out, you know, did I aggravate a parent? Did I not turn in a form? I also had our twin sons in school, the same school I was teaching in, which is always a delightful experience, having your two boys there, because they are boys and they get in trouble from time to time. But as I walked into our assistant principal's office, she came around from her desk, put her arms around me, and said, "I'm so sorry. The church just called. Don has been in a horrible accident."
Now, at the same moment you heard about your husband's injuries, you felt that God was telling you some information about your husband's condition, and that comforted you.
Yes. As soon as she said those words, just a feeling of peace came over me, and God spoke to me and said, "This is going to be difficult. This is going to be hard, but it's going to be okay because I am with you. Don has two broken legs and a broken arm." And at that point, we didn't even know where he was. We didn't know where the accident had taken place. We didn't know what hospital he had been taken to. We had no word whatsoever. But as time went on and we did finally locate Don, the nurse told me that we are assessing his injuries, but we do know he has two broken legs and a broken arm. I firmly believe that God gave me those concrete facts so that I could hold on to the fact, the more general fact, that things were going to be okay, that he was right there in the midst of all this and was going to walk me through my dark time.
And the actual reality of Don's condition, though, was pretty bad. How long was he in the hospital and how many surgeries did he have to undergo?
He was in the hospital for a continuous 105 days. He came home and then we had to take him back. He was in and out of the hospital for about a year and a half. Had 34 surgeries, was in rehab recovery for about 2.5 years, and still deals on a day-to-day basis with the pain from the injuries. His left leg ended up being about 1.5 inches shorter than his right, so that throws everything out of kink, so to speak, as he has trouble with his back. But he is a determined man, and he keeps moving.
Now let's talk about your being a caregiver and some of your difficult moments with his recovery. Now the first, he had a lot of trouble breathing, and yet he was unwilling to work on his breathing. He said it hurt too much. How did you resolve his problem? And did you know at the time that your husband was clinically depressed? Because I think a lot of caregivers don't realize that that can go along with an injury.
Right. No, I didn't. I had not really dealt with depression in my life. I just thought he was being stubborn and had given up, which was a very difficult thing for me because Don had always been the strong person in our marriage. He had been the one that had taken care of the difficult decisions, and I could always turn to him when I was having a hard time. Now those roles were reversed, and I had to come out of my comfort zone and start really pushing and asking questions of medical personnel and friends and anyone that I could find. How do I help? What do I do? And I had to come to it was hurtful. I will admit it was hurtful for me to admit that I couldn't fix this. I could not fix his depression. I had to, even though I felt that as his wife I was supposed to be able to do everything for him, I had to turn to his very best friend, David Gentiles, and gave him a call. He was living about an hour and a half drive from me. He was over in San Antonio, and said, "David, I need you. I can't get through to Dawn." And David left immediately, drove to Houston up to Herman Memorial Hospital, spent about 10 minutes with Dawn, and that was that was the changing point, because he told Dawn he didn't have to do this. They were going to pray him through it. And it made a difference. After that, Dawn started working, trying to get better. Even though the depression would still be there, at least he was making an effort to get better.
You had to do something that was so difficult. What a decision you had to make, whether to give permission to have your husband's leg amputated or to try to save it by putting on a very heavy and painful frame on his leg for months. What made you decide on that horrible, monstrous device?
That was a hard decision. The doctor came out from the ICU unit and just sat down with me and said, "Okay, we've gotten him through this. He had actually developed double pneumonia, and that was where the breathing difficulties came in. We've now gotten that a little clear, but we can't clear it up completely unless we can raise him up. And with the leg the way it was, we can't do that. We can either amputate or we can put on a new device that has never been tried on the femur before, which is, that he explained it to me as like an exoskeleton type of thing that would support the bone. And I just bowed my head, I prayed, and I knew Don loved to walk. He loved to play tennis. He loved to ride his bike. And in my mind, he would have a better chance of doing those things keeping his own leg. So I made that decision to put the Elizaroff device on. I have to admit, I had no idea how painful it was going to be. I didn't realize that there would be 32 wires going all the way through his leg to stretch those bones back together. I think if I had known that, I'm not sure I would have gone ahead and put that on him. But after it was on and there, it's one of those things as a caregiver, you make decisions and you can't go back and question yourself.
You are so right.
You go with what you know and you make the best decision you do at that point in time, and then you just have to go forward with it.
Now, during the time that you were Don's caregiver in the hospital, 24/7, friends from your church taught you an important lesson about taking care of your own needs. So what did you learn? Because it's a good lesson that we all need to learn.
Yes, it is. She came to me and she said, "You're looking kind of tired." And I said, "Well, you know, being up here all the time trying to take care of Don, worrying about our three young children, I am tired." And she goes, "Well, I'm going to tell you this, and I tell you this out of love. You can't take care of Don if you don't take care of yourself." And those words were so true. I learned that taking care of myself sometimes meant just walking out of the room and taking a walk down the hall. Sometimes it meant finding a quiet place in the hospital. They had a chapel area. They had a little garden area that I could go to and just sit quietly and either read my Bible or just sit and soak up some solitude, quiet time. Sometimes that meant getting in my car and driving along and screaming at the top of my lungs or singing along with the radio, but something just to take my mind off of what was going on so that when I went back in that room, my mind was clearer, it was sharper, and I could make better decisions for Dawn.
Now, Eva, let's switch gears a bit and talk about Don's life-changing event,
A
terrible car crash, the steering wheel impaled his chest, the car roof collapsed on his head, his heart stopped beating, 4 paramedics pronounced him dead, and your husband said that when he opened his eyes, he knew that he was immediately in heaven. And how did he describe being in heaven, and why do you both say it was not a near-death experience or the result of being in a coma?
Well, one reason is the accident happened at 11:45, and he, you know, once the other pastor got in the car, it was 1:15 before they actually, you know, pronounced him alive again. You can't be dead for 90 minutes and be nearly dead. So he had such horrible gaping wounds that if his heart had still been beating, he would have bled out, and he did not do that. Don, I wish there was a way for you to see his face when he starts talking about heaven. It's just this most peaceful, excited expression comes over his face. His eyes light up when he starts talking about being just immediately there at the gates of heaven and opening his eyes and watching his grandfather come toward him, watching his grandmother being there, friends from high school, friends from the neighborhood, teachers, aunts and uncles who were all there to greet him. He says it was such a great reunion. He talks about heaven being a buffet for the senses. He said there were colors that he'd never seen before, smells that he'd never smelled before, sounds that he'd not heard before. He talks about hearing the angels' wings beating and the music. Just we are both great lovers of music, and he talks about hearing thousands and thousands of songs that all fit together, all worshiping God. The beautiful, beautiful gate of pearl. He says it was almost lifelike. It was glimmering. It was shimmering, and this almost like sculpted out of mother of pearl that led into the city that did have streets of gold, mansions lining both sides of the street. And again, I wish there was a way to capture his face when he talks about that. It is so real to him. He will say heaven is more real than anything he has ever experienced here on earth.
Eva Piper, in conversation with Carol Marks. The book is titled A Walk Through the Dark, How My Husband's 90 Minutes in Heaven Deepened My Faith for a Lifetime, published by Thomas Nelson. Carol Marks returns in just a moment with another interesting conversation when A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues.
More than 100 million wild animals are killed each year illegally. Poaching is a major threat to our country's wildlife. I'm Tom Barry. I'm an actor with a desire to preserve living space for wildlife. The Humane Society Wildlife Land Trust does just that. Works with private landowners to protect wildlife, to preserve natural habitats. To learn more or to work with the Humane Society Wildlife Land Trust, call 800-729-SAVE. That's 800-729-SAVE or visit wildlifelandtrust.org. Thank you.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison. Here again is the host, Carol Marks, in conversation now with Ajit Varkey. He's a physician scientist who's currently distinguished professor of medicine in cellular and molecular medicine at the University of California, San Diego. He's got a new book out. It's called Denial, Self-Deception, False Beliefs, and the Origins of the Human Mind, published by 12.
Do you want to be a physician from a very early age and went to one of the leading medical schools in India? What made you decide on a career as a physician scientist, and what areas of science were you focused on?
So I realized going along that I could do the most in the long run by pursuing science rather than practical clinical applications. And so I focused on studying the surface of cells and how they differ from each other, and cancer and normal development and between species. And so that led me to happen to stumble on the first difference between humans and chimpanzees, our closest relatives.
And you came to the United States in 1975 to pursue your research. Why did you come to the United States?
So the United States is rare. It's one of the few countries in the world where physicians do research on par with PhD scientists. They're given equal opportunity. In most other countries, physicians practice medicine and do some clinical research, whereas in the U.S., you have opportunities to do, you know, equivalent or basic research, but you have the knowledge of medicine behind you. So the term physician scientist is the term that's normally used for people like me. I'm board certified in medicine, hematology, and oncology. And I used to spend about 10 to 20% of my time practicing. I don't anymore. I still teach medical students.
Now, you went on to develop an interest in the biologic and genetic differences between humans and animals, as you mentioned, and then they certainly contribute to our unique attributes. One day, you met Danny Brower, a well-known professor of biology, and he was asking a very unique question. why are we the only species that got so brainy? And did that intrigue you, that question?
Yes, it very much intrigued me because I had already spent about 15 years thinking about this problem, starting with my molecular findings. And Danny was taking a very contrarian view. Instead of asking, you know, what made us human, which is the standard question, he said, well, there's been a lot of very smart animals, birds, dolphins, elephants, whales, chimpanzees. They've been around for tens of millions of years. Why is it that there's only one human? Why isn't there human-like elephants? So in other words, he turned the question on its head. Instead of saying what made us human, he said, what might have prevented all these other animals from becoming like us?
And that's certainly a wonderful way to look at it because it makes us think. Now, fast-forwarding, 2 years after you met Danny Brower, you wanted to talk with him further about his ideas on human evolution. You found out he died suddenly of an aortic aneurysm. What happened, though, when you got an unexpected email from Danny's widow, and what did that lead to?
So what happened is I found that Danny had not published anything, so I wrote a letter to a journal called Nature describing Danny's idea and adding some ideas of my own. Unfortunately, Sharon Brower, Danny's widow, happened to hear about this letter and contacted me and said that Danny had been spending night and day trying to write a book on the subject and had unfortunately died after finishing the second draft. And she realized it was an incomplete book and so asked me if I would finish the book, and I gladly agreed.
Now, up until Danny's theory, and you're taking a look at it and expanding on it, you know, really the thought had been that what sets humans apart from other species are the fact that we've got improved biological differences. And you went on, because of Danny's help with that unfinished manuscript, to state that, as he had put forth, that it really wasn't a great biological leap that had helped humans to be different from other species, but that it was a psychological one, and that it was a psychological ability to deny, despite all the overwhelming evidence, that we were going to die. So can you describe this phenomenon in more detail and what it's done and what it hasn't done for us?
Sure. So underlying all this, of course, it is biology, but instead of saying some special biological things happened, the idea is that the ability to go on to being like we are was initially negative. So there is this complicated idea called theory of mind, but in put in very simple terms, I'm not only self-aware, I'm aware that you're self-aware, and I'm aware that you're aware that I'm self-aware, and that's why we're able to have this conversation over the phone. I can imagine your mind, you can imagine my mind. I can even imagine the minds of your listeners later who will be thinking about what you and I are saying to each other. So this unique ability is called, sometimes called theory of mind, there are many other words, and it's uniquely human. So without that, many of the things we do wouldn't work. So the question is, why didn't all the other animals get the same ability? And the contrarian idea Danny came up with is the first time that we became completely aware of the minds of others, first time it happened in any animal, the initial benefit may be huge. You can read the minds of others, you can deceive others, you can understand others. But then one of them dies, and for the first time you have an animal that's completely aware of its own mortality. And the immediate response to that is going to be a negative one. This individual is not going to succeed. It's going to be full of existential angst and an inability to perform, you know, and pass your genes on. And the idea then is that the second component which was needed was this ability to deny mortality and reality. And that's also a negative. And any animal that goes around denying reality is going to be in trouble very soon. So we took two negatives, brought them together at one instant in evolution, and came out with a positive. That's basically the theory.
Now, also, the bad thing about denying our reality is that we can go ahead and do things that we want to do that we know aren't good for us, like smoking cigarettes and eating unhealthy foods. Any comments about that?
Yes. So once we had this denial, so Danny had originally suggested some specific mechanism to deny mortality. But then as I read his draft, I realized he was talking about a general mechanism to deny reality. So this ability is actually very powerful on the one hand, because after all, what is optimism? Optimism is denying reality. What is bravery? What is courage? You know, the many things we do, take on challenges, fight cancer, do various things, which come from our denial of reality, so they're positives. So the negative is that when we deny things that we should not deny, like you mentioned, personal health, but it goes all the way to our, you know, immediate social surroundings, our families, our society, for example, our national debt, and ultimately the most serious denial of all is the denial of climate change.
So how do you think we can balance out these two parts of the way we look at reality, denying some of it, such as our mortality, and yet in doing that, being able to do lots of good things that require courage and sacrifice?
Yes, so this is a difficult balance, because obviously if you got up every day and worried about everything and really appreciated reality for what it is, we'd never get through the day. So we need this ongoing denial of not only reality, I mean of mortality, but of many unpleasant things around us, so that we can have optimism and courage and move forward. On the other hand, we need to balance that by identifying those issues where denial is bad. And it's a tricky balance, because the default position of humans seems to be to deny. And then we have to wake up from that and realize that there's some things they shouldn't deny.
Anything else that you hope your readers will take away from reading your book? Because I think it points out so well the fact that the negative things about denying reality, which most of us never have thought about.
Right. So although the emphasis of the book and the title is on denial, the other component of the theory is this understanding of the minds of others. And this ability, which is uniquely human, can be used to be a Hitler or a Mother Teresa. It can be used to, you know, do medicine or torture. In other words, the ability to read each other's minds also is a double-edged sword. And so that component also we need to pay attention to. And the final part of the story is a more academic story, which you started with, is what made us human? Where did we come from? There's this very strange fact that about 20, 30, 40,000 years ago, there were many other human-like species on the planet. And then we emerged from Africa, mated very little with the rest of them, and replaced everybody else. And here we are, we've taken over the planet. And so I hypothesize that this evolutionary transition, which I call mind over reality as a sort of short form, in other words, the emergence of theory of mind along with denial of reality, occurred only once. And I have hypothesized, and this is testable in many ways, that this explains why there's only one human-like species that replaced everybody else. So there's an academic story behind it, too, which is of general interest.
Ajit Varkey, in conversation with Carol Marx. His book is titled Denial, Self-Deception, False Beliefs, and the Origins of the Human Mind, published by 12. Carol Marx conducted the interview. More A Touch of Grey coming your way in just a moment.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security websites. Pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
This is a Driving Today Minute. Even though high gasoline prices have moderated somewhat, they're still quite high. It just makes good sense to do what you can do to reduce your fuel costs. The Alliance to Save Energy suggests a few easy things you can do.
Keep your car properly tuned up and change the air filter regularly, both to save gas and protect your engine. Curtail aggressive driving, according to the U.S. Department of Energy. Speeding, rapid acceleration, and hard braking waste gas and curb mileage by as much as 33% at highway speeds.
So nix the jackrabbit starts and opt instead for slow acceleration from a dead stop. Slow down. The DOE says each mile per hour you drive over 60 is like paying an extra 10 cents per gallon. Inflate tires to the proper pressure. This will increase fuel economy and make tires safer and extend their life.
This Driving Today Minute is brought to you by Bridgestone Firestone Tires. You can get more information like this at drivingtoday.com or by visiting our partners such as autobytel.com, motorsportsforum.com, and more.
You're listening to A Touch of Gray. Check out our website at atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E. That's atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to godirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
If you plan to apply for Social Security disability benefits, there are things you can do to help speed up the usual 3 to 5 month wait for a decision. The more information you provide up front, the less time it'll take us to obtain the needed evidence, and the faster the decision can be made. Information like medical records or documentation, the names, addresses, and phone numbers of your doctors and medical facilities, information on your past employment, and more. To be prepared, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/disability and select Disability Starter Kits.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair this 4th of July holiday weekend. Hope it is a four-day weekend for you and that you're enjoying the second half of it. And we come to the point in our show where we'll be joined for the rest of the program by our senior correspondent, Richard Neer. Richard Neer, in just a few minutes, will be speaking with Wendy Spencer. She's the CEO of the Corporation for National and Community Service. That's the CNCS. She served as the CEO of the Florida Governor's Commission on Volunteerism and is the first CEO to come to CNCS from the field of national service. She's going to talk to Richard about the impact that senior volunteers have on our nation's communities. And Richard, I know you already conducted that interview. Will we find out interesting and provocative information?
Yes, and it will go contrary to the advice I was given as a young man, which was never volunteer. Did you get the same advice?
Isn't that something they say to people in the service? Don't volunteer or you'll wind up in trouble.
Yes, or dead.
Yeah, yeah.
They will make you cannon fodder. Who wants to be on the front line? Oh, me.
I remember when I was a kid in school And they would say, okay, who wants to be in charge of cleaning the blackboards? Everybody would go, me, me, me. Who wants to take the water, you know, the pails out to the boys' room or the girls' room to bring back the water to wash the blackboards? Me, me. Do you remember that stuff? And then they'd have elections for who gets to draw the shades at the end of the day and who cleans the chalkboards and who straightens the desks. And those were like honors, you know. You had to be voted on to get that.
Well, that's like running for student council, you know. Mm-hmm. You thought that was a big honor, and then you get on there, and it's just like a club.
But volunteerism for seniors, I would imagine it first of all is very helpful in hospital situations and in tourist situations. I'm not fully educated to the spectrum of what fields have volunteers, but I know you see them in hospitals. You see them in places where there are community and civic events. Election headquarters. I live in New England, and going to vote is like a small town, something you'd think of from the past. You know, it's very quaint, and you see the volunteers from the neighborhood, usually seasoned citizens, helping out. I think it's good, you know, for the community, and it provides purpose and something meaningful in the lives of people who may not, you know, be at the point in their life where they actually want to hold a paid job.
You know, even in the world of sports, with the golf tournaments, all the marshals you see are not paid. They're volunteers. Mm. A lot of them are boomers who love the sport. And, you know, you get the little side benefits. You get to be close to the golfers. You get to meet them. You get to stay inside the ropes and actually see things a lot better. So there are some benefits to it over and above the good feeling you have from helping out.
Looking forward to hearing the interview. Another thing just popped in my mind. Community theater has volunteers. And even local regional theater that you pay to get in, they have volunteers hand out the programs and take you to your seat. I'm looking forward to this. Richard Neer speaking with Wendy Spencer about volunteerism. That's next. And then Richard will be rejoining us at the conclusion of the program. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and you're plugged into A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security webpages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said you're the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps, so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage, when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare-only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare-only.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and as promised, here again is our senior correspondent, Richard Neer, in conversation with Wendy Spencer. She is the CEO of the Corporation for National and Community Service, CNCS. She served as a CEO of the Florida Governor's Commission on Volunteerism and is the first CEO to come to CNCS from the field of national service. She's going to talk to Richard about the impact that senior volunteers have on our nation's communities.
Well, what are Senior Corps? Is this an organization, a formal organization? Is it sort of loosely organized? Tell us what Senior Corps is all about.
So the Corporation for National and Community Service, you mentioned, is a federal agency, and we provide support to organizations throughout America to engage Americans of all ages in volunteer service and in national service. So we have two national service programs. One's called AmeriCorps, very much like Peace Corps, but for America, and the other is called Senior Corps. So this is an opportunity for seniors age 55 and older to participate in one of three programs, foster grandparents, senior companions, and a program called RSVP, Retired Senior Volunteer Program. And that those three programs comprise our Senior Corps volunteers and participants. They make up 362,000 seniors are participating in our Senior Corps programs across America in 55,000 locations. So they're very busy.
Well, and it seems like if you've worked your entire life and you put aside a nice little nest egg and you want to do something positive, give something back, this seems to be a perfect opportunity.
You know, it really is for a couple of reasons. One is, you've developed over the years great skills that you've honed over decades, nurturing skills, skills based from your work or employment or raising a family. So you've got those skills to offer community organizations, to offer mentoring, support to others in need. But there's also a personal benefit. Research tells us that volunteering actually is a health benefit. It keeps you active and engaged. It lowers your stress. It reduces your sense of isolation. It actually makes you happier. And you meet people, too. So oftentimes, as we age, unfortunately, sometimes we become more isolated. Family members are relocating across the country. Some of your friends are moving on to other places. So volunteering keeps you active and so a way keeps you happier. So it's a way to meet people as well.
Well, and the thing I find interesting, too, is working with children, because I can't tell you how many grandparents I know dote on their grandchildren much more than they did on their own children. And I think part of it is that they've learned lessons over the years of raising children, and they know what mistakes were made, and they're much wiser in terms of mentoring and counseling. And they're thus able, I think, to be better parents to children that they might be working with than they were parents to their own children.
You know, it's so true. And I think it's actually in our culture that as young adults, young people, even adults, we respect our grandparents to a degree that we don't provide respect sometimes to our peers, sometimes even our parents. There's just this sort of innate culture to respect your grandparents. And a great story that I just was able to be introduced to and met some individuals in Austin, Texas 2 weeks ago is I met this young, troubled, at the time, he's now 18, but at the time he was about 13 years old. He was in juvenile detention where we have a foster grandparent program. These foster grandparents go in this juvenile detention and they get to know the children who are in trouble and incarcerated. They just show them love. They don't judge them. They don't try to give them advice that is unsolicited. They just show them a lot of love and support. Well, 5 years went by, and this young man who was incarcerated at a young age with some drug and alcohol abuse,
he got out of juvenile detention. He was reintroduced to these foster grandparents, Grandma Piper and Grandma Chavez, and at a ceremony pulling together AmeriCorps members and Senior Corps volunteers in Austin with the mayor, and he hadn't seen him in 5 years. And he said, "Hey, Grandma, remember me? I was in the juvenile detention center. I'm grown up now. I'm getting a high school degree. I'm going to be a firefighter, and I'm a part of AmeriCorps. I've succeeded, and it's because of you. You showed me love when very many adults were not showing me love at a time that I needed it." So there's so many things that a senior can offer.
And especially when you talk about drug intervention, because let's face it, in our 55-plus baby boomers, we went through the 60s and 70s when drugs were around, and I think might be tending to be a little less judgmental about them and a little bit more understanding about the problems they cause than millennial parents who, you know, things have changed. I think we've tightened up a little bit about that, and I think, you know, the older folks might understand a little bit better than maybe some of the younger ones.
You know, that's a very good point, Richard. That could easily be the case in thousands of situations where we find our young people troubled and faced with drug and alcohol abuse, who are plagued with so many things, poverty, parents who are incarcerated, single-parent families. But I'm so encouraged. This is Older Americans Month. We celebrate that every May. And I'm so encouraged that senior volunteerism, as we rank it every year, is up. More seniors are volunteering than they ever have, at least in the last 5 years. 31.2% of seniors are volunteering. That's up 6 points since 2002. So this is a good trend we're in, and that's actually through formal organizations. So that 31.2% is through a Boys and Girls Club or through a school-organized volunteer program. Seniors volunteer at a very high rate, just informally, helping their neighbors and others. It's right at 73% of all seniors across the nation, you know, help the neighbors, do favors, provide transportation and other support. So we really need to look to our seniors for support, and we know that it helps them keep active, stay engaged, and stay youthful.
And another thing, too, we've just experienced the terrible tornadoes in Oklahoma. Of course, we had Sandy on the East Coast. We've had Katrina. Disaster relief, very important, too, because you're at a stage in your life where if you've been a builder or have worked over the years putting things together, that your expertise and your knowledge can be very, very helpful at helping people from disasters recover from natural disasters.
It really is, and one real good skill set that seniors have is they are wonderful call center operators. So if we put them on a call center where people are calling in, need help, or they want to volunteer, or they're distressed and they're trying to get connected to services, seniors have this very calming effect about them. They're not easily stirred. They've been through a lot. So they can be good coaches and counselors to people in need. I just returned from West Texas where they had that horrible explosion at the plant there, at the fertilizer plant, and we had many seniors were affected, but we had a large contingent of Senior Corps volunteers that we work with who were not only affected but were there to respond and help. So they were providing, and I met them personally, and I asked them, why, you know, you've been impacted, why are you trying to help other people? And they said, you know what, it's part of the healing process. Yes, I've been impacted, but am I going to sit in my house or stay with family members if my house has been destroyed and just complain about it? I feel better getting out and helping others who have been impacted. So it's just, you know, we really need to look to our seniors to support us more in all kinds of situations.
Wendy, do you have a website or a telephone number for people who would like more information about volunteering?
We do. Thanks, Richard. Serve.gov. Serve.gov, you can go to serve.gov, type in your zip code, and up will pop opportunities to volunteer in your neighborhood. And that's the easiest way. And I always ask people to take a friend. In fact, no matter what age you are, why don't you find a senior who may be lonely and ask them to go and volunteer with you? It'll perk their day up, and you'll be doing it together.
That's Wendy Spencer in conversation with Richard Neer talking about seniors and volunteerism. If you'd like more information, go to serve.gov. That's serve.gov. Richard Neer returns for some final words when we hit the final segment of our two-hour get-together. I'm Michael Harrison. More coming your way when A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/MedicareOnly. That's socialsecurity.gov/MedicareOnly.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
She's conquered some of the most challenging ski courses anywhere, but with only one leg, the odds were against her even walking.
The growth was stunted in my right leg when I was born, and the doctors told my mother we needed to amputate when I was 5 years old.
Bonnie was helped at a Shriners Hospital, one of a network of 22 hospitals helping kids throughout North America. Shriners Hospitals provide world-class orthopedic and burn medical care, and they offer that care totally free of charge.
The care and treatment the Shriners gave me was a gift. It wasn't just about learning to walk. They helped me to believe in myself.
There's a Shriners Hospital helping kids from this area realize their dreams.
If I went back to the Shriners Hospital and talked to the nurses and doctors, I would say thank you. Thank you for making my dreams come true.
If you know a child they could help, call 1-800-237-5055. Shriners, giving help and hope to kids for over 80 years.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to GoDirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Continuing with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. We come to the final segment of our big two-hour get-together, and we're rejoined by our senior correspondent, Richard Neer. Richard, as mentioned before, this show is being heard on Saturday and Sunday in different parts of the country, the final 2 days of what for many is a four-day 4th of July holiday weekend. And I know in my neighborhood, the fireworks, some local golf courses and country clubs did it professionally, and then there are always those who buy their homemade fireworks. People were shooting them off 3-4 days in advance of the 4th, and I'm still hearing them around town. In the state I live, they're illegal. The neighboring state, they are legal, so a lot of people go across the state and buy them. I remember when we were kids growing up on Long Island, we would, as kids, go into Chinatown in New York City and buy firecrackers. And, that was such a big deal. But at this point in my life, I think it's a pretty dangerous endeavor for people to engage in home fireworks.
Well, you know what? I was always afraid to use fireworks because back when I was, I don't know, second grade, third grade, there was this thing called my weekly reader. Did you have that?
Of course.
And in it, there were these little short stories. And there was a short story about this kid who played with fireworks and was blinded.
Ugh.
And I thought, oh, man, I don't want to ever get blinded. And it was one of those instructional, don't play with fireworks, kids. But it was around this whole story. And he became productive and, you know, he had a nice life and everything. But the first chapter was about him, the fireworks going off in his face and blinding him. And ever since reading that, I said, oh.
Isn't that something that stuck with you? You know, I remember we called it the Weekly Reader. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was my Weekly Reader. But if I recall, and, you know, they probably still exist. It's probably online. But we got this little, like a newspaper, once a week, and it had very simple stories. I remember, you know, second, third, fourth grade, I believe.
Yeah, it was like the Reader's Digest for kids.
For kids. And I found it to be tremendously influential and very educational. The two things I remember that really influenced me as a kid that I remember to this day was Weekly Reader and also a junior savings account at the local bank where they came into school and they set you up and you were able to make your deposit of like a quarter or a dime a month. and they taught you how to save at a bank with your own bank book.
Now, you see, in those days, that was viewed as nurturing good values and thrift and all of that. Nowadays, it would be viewed as, you see, these evil bankers are trying to hook these kids into their brand early so that they'll go to Wells Fargo or Bank of America and they'll stick with them through their lives. So it's marketing. It's not community service. It's not trying to inculcate good values into the kids. That would be the take today, I bet.
Yeah, but today they would say, kids, you know, when we did it, it was you put a penny in once a month and you'll get interest. And today it would be, hey, give us your bicycle, and we'll get you 1% more interest over the next 10 years. You can't use your bicycle, you know. If you want your bike back, we're going to keep one of your tires.
Yes, the reverse bicycle mortgage thing. Well, it's interesting though. But do you remember Christmas clubs where you would?
Oh my gosh! Yes.
In June or something, they would encourage you to put in $1 a week or something like that. So by the time Christmas rolled around, you'd have enough to buy gifts.
Do you remember layaway?
Layaway
plans. They
my first train set was on layaway. I saw it. I couldn't afford it, so they put it on layaway.
On layaway, yes.
And I give them a certain amount of money every couple of weeks, and by the time 6 weeks later, 6 months later, I'd get the train set.
Yeah, they put it aside so that you would get it at the same price and that nobody else would, you know, grab it. Interesting stuff. Richard Neer, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you, Beverly Santanella, on the front line, our producer. Carol Marks, the star and founder and guiding light of the show, we thank you. Steve Wiseman, Kevin Casey, the entire Touch of Grey broadcast team. On behalf of all of us, I'm Michael Harrison, your friendly anchor, inviting you to join us next weekend right here for another 2-hour installment of A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups.